from WABE in Atlanta. This is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thanks for listening to our daily look at arts and culture. Those two words put together often evoke images of fancy cocktail parties full of serious people or of esoteric performance art. But today, we're highlighting the ways that art can be fun and funny. Artist Jiha Moon puts together gorgeous and colorful paintings that mix classic Asian styles with Angry Birds and other pieces of pop culture. We'll talk to her, and later in the hour, comedian Scott Adsett from 30 Rock drops in ahead of his weekend at Dad's Garage Improv Theater. Be sure to stick around for that. Threads of time, tradition, and change in Indigenous American textiles is the new exhibition at the Carlos Museum on the campus of Emory University. The exhibit is filled with textiles from the Andes, Guatemala, and Panama, from ancient to modern. I spoke with the curator and Emory art history professor, Rebecca Stone, about the exhibit, along with the Carlos Museum's chief conservator, Renee Stein. We don't usually think of textiles as surviving for hundreds of years, but this exhibition has several pieces that are ancient. I understand we have the weather to thank for that in large part. So how did some of these ancient textiles come to survive?
Well, the ones that we have in the show that are ancient come from Peru, and they have the driest coastal desert in the world on the edge of Peru, on the Pacific. There are places that have never recorded a single drop of rainfall. But this is where the textiles were buried, usually with mummies, because mummification actually began in the Americas, not in Egypt, about 500 years before the Egyptians did artificial mummification technique. The people in northern Chile had already done a version of it. And so mummies have been around for millennia. The ones in Chile come from 5500 BC and later. So the people are dressed for the afterlife, and they take all their things with them. It's a funny thing. You can say you can't take it with you, but the Andeans felt that you could.
Why don't we know more about that? Why do we associate mummies with Egypt and therefore presume that that's where mummification began?
Well, there's a long prejudice, I think, against the Americas as a creative place. I think many people who live on the continent now came from somewhere else, and they see it as a secondary part of the world. Whereas, and even calling it the New World, that's what the Europeans, it was new to the Europeans, but it wasn't new. If we've had mummies for 7,000 years and we have a basket, a piece of an old basket from 8,800 BC that was preserved in a dry cave in Peru. But our school system doesn't pay very much attention to it. And we need to address this ignorance. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to do this show for many years, was partly because people aren't even aware that these textiles from ancient times exist. And they just don't appreciate the native peoples of this continent as much as they really should.
How did the Carlos end up preserving them?
We have been given gifts of textiles. We have 700 textiles, and they were all given to us. Partly because people knew that was a specialty of mine, and they want, and textiles are really, frankly, a hassle to keep yourself. You know, they fade. You don't really do them justice to keep them in your house. The humidity will hurt them, light will hurt them. So many times people say, I'd like a museum to take these off our hands in a way. I had so much to choose from for this show, which has almost 150 pieces in it. It's a large exhibition.
And because it's so large and we have so many textiles, the work for this project to prepare the objects actually extends back into even before we started this exhibition. When the gifts came to the museum, they were processed into the collection and then housed in order to make them accessible for the study and research and classes. And in that process, we treated the textiles that needed to be stabilized and identified the ones that were going to need more work to get them ready for display. So that's been a whole nother piece of getting the exhibition ready that has sort of its roots in our long-term efforts to preserve these objects.
I was going to ask you, Renee, how much of your work is conserving and how much is restoring?
That is probably answered on an object-by-object basis, but I can definitely say that the vast majority is conservation. As a current conservation professional, our goal is to preserve what comes to us from the past and conserve it for the future. We're not interested so much in restoring it to what it once was. But there is an element of restoration to some of the treatments that I undertake. For example, if I need to make an object whole again and the fragment that connects two parts is missing and I can with confidence recreate what is missing, then I will restore that part in order to create the unity and the attachment that was missing between those two pieces. But it is never really my goal to restore something to its original appearance. It has a long life and it should look old, but not battered and unappreciated for that life.
When people hear textiles, they often think clothing, fabric that is made into clothing. What are some of the other uses of textiles seen in this exhibition?
Well, I would have to say the majority do have a clothing aspect. And we tend to separate out art from craft, and we tend to put textiles into craft. I don't subscribe to that dichotomy. I think you have to be very good at crafting in any art form. And I also see these indigenous women artists, these are made by women. We do have many other uses besides garments. We do have three textiles that are used by shamans, sacred textiles for holding the bundle of power objects that they use to cure people. We have one from the modern Maya, one from modern Bolivia, and one that's almost 1,000 years old from ancient Peru that was filled originally, and we still have its little miniature textiles that are inside the bundle. So these are very interesting because textiles to us are not so sacred unless maybe worn by the Pope or by a rabbi or something like that. But weaving has a sacred and cosmological significance because it's so elemental. The strings that are crossing each other form the four directions, for example, and they're orderly. Textiles are nothing if not orderly. You can't make a cloth if you're disorderly. It will unravel or it will be tangled. It won't be a real beautiful textile. So they embody order and cosmic knowledge in many ways. The other amazing use of textiles, and this is where the show begins, is as writing. Now, we define writing, we think it's usually when you make marks on a page or a papyrus or maybe scratch cuneiform, but the Inca and some people before them took strings and tied them together and put different knots in them, and that was their writing, and they're called quipu. And we have three of them, and there's about 800 left in the world, so we feel very privileged that we have three in our collection. They also posed a really interesting conservation and testing, scientific testing problem for us that I think Renee should discuss.
The three of them also present three different types of materials. So one of them is made from animal fiber that has been dyed, and so it was quite colorful, although those colors have faded over time. And then the second one is made of cotton, and so a plant fiber. And the third is a different plant fiber and much more unusual, and sort of presented us with the question of what is this material? It was not common to the rest of the fiber objects or textile objects in our collection until we started looking. And we actually undertook some examination and analysis to try to identify this fiber. This was actually the project of a Mellon Fellow who had come to our lab for 2 years to do research and treatment and as part of her professional development on her way to being a conservator. She had already gotten a graduate degree. And she spent that 2 years working on all sorts of projects in our collection and took this on quite wholeheartedly, tracked down researchers throughout the world, sent them samples. What is this stuff? And of course, we can only remove a few millimeters of a fiber for identification purposes. So you're very limited in what material you have. You don't want to send it to hundreds of folks because that's hundreds of millimeters. So you take one little sample, get really good pictures, send it to the right people, and ultimately get a plant identification, which turned out to be a Fricrea andina, so a native grass plant from South America. And then recognizing it in the case of this particular single strand from a quipu, we also found it to be evident on other objects in the collection, particularly some fans that have feathers on them. So then we were curious about when were these fibers used. So the same conservator took very small samples and sent them for stable isotope analysis at University of Georgia in Athens, and we got a carbon-14 date. And so we know that they are both ancient, not a modern use of a local fiber to recreate something from antiquity, but in fact an ancient object in a material that we were less familiar with prior to this research. So those are included in the exhibition, and some of this technical research and notes appear as well in the online catalog that Rebecca has written and included some of this information.
So much science in this art.
Absolutely.
Yes, that's right.
If you are just joining us, this is City Lights on WABE, where ATL meets NPR. Talking with Dr. Rebecca Stone of the art faculty at Emory University and Renee Stein, who is conservator at the Carlos Museum. We're discussing threads of time, tradition and change in indigenous American textiles on view at the Carlos through December 17th. Throughout time, we see how people in the Andes, Guatemala, and Panama began incorporating Spanish imports into their work. Things like the guitars and horses and the Habsburg eagles. But thinking about the disease and violence that the Spaniards brought to indigenous people in the New World. Were those elements reflected in the textiles? Is there any expression of the suffering of foreign infliction?
Well, I think there are political aspects. Certainly when they incorporated the Habsburg eagle, which is a double-headed eagle that had been used for many things, the Holy Roman Empire and others, and it just happened to be that the last two Spanish rulers were from the Habsburgs, Charles V and Philip III. But what's interesting is that the pieces, we have one that's from the Guna people of Panama, that's a blouse panel made by women, and we have one that's an altar cloth from the Maya from 1890. They both have this double-headed eagle. In the Guna, they have the idea of multiple-headed animals. Right next to it in the show, we have a six-headed snake that they put into one of their blouse panels. And multiple-headed animals are often seen in visions that shamans have, and the Guna are still shamanic in many ways in their religion. So this, when we see it and say it's the Habsburg eagle, it's an example of what an important theme in the show is syncretism, which means two schools of thought or religions that somehow overlap so that it could mean the different things to different people. So the Spanish could say, oh, aren't they being nice little Spanish subjects by putting the Habsburg eagle? And the Guna could say, well, you all have a funny two-headed eagle, but to us it means something very different. It's a spirit that we see on the fourth level of the universe or something like that. So they can have two meanings. There can be subversive information, what you might call subversive, where it looks like a good Catholic situation, but underneath it there might be shamanic content. And I spoke of the sacred cloths. This is particularly important in the use of these shamanic cloths. I was reading a book written in 1940 about what the people in this town called Chichicastenango, which is a fun place to say, do And the shaman will actually bring the sacred cloth full of the power objects into the Catholic Church during Mass and use it, making the sign of the cross, but the four-direction cross, not a more vertical Catholic cross, the north, south, east, west, on top of his patient's head in the middle of Mass.
Rebecca, how do some of the more recently made textiles reflect current styles and cultural moments?
The Guna are wonderful with this because they are very open to the world. They live in the country of Panama. The Panama Canal is where the entire world coalesces and goes through. And they are very topical in their imagery. We have one example that has the Panama Canal in it with a ship. But the sky is completely done in spiral geometric patterns, which they are call their grandmother patterns, the most ancient and most cosmological patterns. We have one that's the Madonna and Child, and the Madonna and Child are done in a lurid pink because we are the white people who look so pink, especially when we get sunburned and go to Central America. We have churches. We have the most wonderful one. We have the Trix cereal rabbit.
Oh, and I heard R2-D2 appears.
We have in modern Bolivia, we just purchased a piece made last year because the idea of the show is tradition and change and coming through time all the way to the present. And it has R2-D2, and he's sideways, and he's in a bright, bright neon green.
Finally. Do you think the type of textiles made today could survive 1,000 years?
I think given the right environmental conditions and preservation efforts, yes. In addition to that, some of the synthetic fibers that we find so readily today will survive the elements even better than some of the natural ones. And so given the right conditions, I think we would see many textiles survive.
Yeah,
I guess. People have to want... Like we have this in a museum collection, and 50 years ago, these wouldn't appear in a museum collection. They weren't valued enough, and they weren't recognized. But with the feminist movement, that these are women's arts, that has helped. Mm-hmm. With more indigenous rights, that has helped. Just the broadness of our knowledge that has been gained. But as a curator, I've directed our collecting in this way. And when I first started, which was 30 years ago at Emory, we only collected ancient things. But I felt that there are still native peoples that are creating and that we needed to keep up and to honor them as they need to be honored in the present.
Rebecca Stone, Renee Stein, this has been fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Emory Art History Professor Rebecca Stone is the curator of Threads of Time, Traditional and Change in Indigenous American Textiles. Renee Stein is the Carlos Museum's chief conservator. Threads of Time is on view at the Carlos Museum through December 17th.
Support for WABE comes from Vacasa, employing local teams to care for privately owned vacation homes across Georgia and Tennessee. More than 150 homes in Helen, Ellijay, Savannah, Pigeon Forge, and beyond at vacasa.com, VACASA.com. And from Persian Rug Market, direct importers of hand-knotted Persian and Oriental rugs for over 40 years. Persian Rug Market is hosting a summer event in Midtown Atlanta on Old Chattahoochee Avenue. Learn more at PersianRugMarket.com.
This is City Lights on WABE, where ATL meets NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thanks for listening. Every 2 years, the Hudgens Center awards a $50,000 prize to one Georgia artist. It's one of the largest prizes of its kind in the entire country. Jiha Moon is one of the four finalists. In her work, she combines traditional iconography from her Korean heritage with contemporary objects like angry birds. I spoke with her about that juxtaposition.
I've been researching source material not only from Korean folk art and things that I really like. At the same time, I also look around the world, what's going on. And of course, I have a son who is 9 now. But when I was making work around with Pennsylvania Dutch folk art that has a lot of like a bird influence on it, and he asked me if I could include some of his favorite thing. So that was one of the iconography was Angry Bird, and it all started out as a joke. But then I really enjoyed it. And then the thing about my work is a lot of time things are hidden, almost a camouflage in a way. So people don't see it immediately, but then they kind of find out later on and they get really fascinated. So from outside, it looked really traditional and kind of old and classic. But then kids come in, the first thing they find is Angry Bird. No matter where they are, they always find it.
It's their radar, huh?
Yeah, and I always think that that's always a good connection to connect with the younger generation to get into art. And my work also deals with humor greatly, and I really enjoy that element.
Yes, I love the whimsical touches. And you're not only combining old with new, you're also combining high culture with popular culture.
Yes, popular culture.
Do you think there are too many barriers between the two?
I think that we only see the extreme like juxtaposition often, and that's the thing we notice most. But in real life, a lot of cases, the things are really blur or gray area. People really don't notice. And I often mimic that in my work. So, of course, you go to the museum and you see the white wall and people get scared. Is it okay for us to go inside? And we are certainly not going to buy the work. But, you know, as an artist, I feel like it should be open all the time for all kinds of everybody. And I kind of feel that it's a lack of it. And as an artist, for me, to invite the cultural references and popular culture is a way to invite people, and they feel like they're invited and look at the work. So for me, combining high culture with lowbrow or popular culture is necessary.
And also another way to express the whimsy and the humor
yes.
that you value. I wondered about, there was one painting that had like a salsa.
Chiquita Banana Lady?
Is that Chiquita Banana?
Yes.
Okay.
Instead, she's holding peaches.
Okay, this is important. I know peaches are very prominent throughout your work. What is the significance of that symbol?
It's something really mysterious and novel in my Asian heritage. At the same time, it's a symbol of like me being in Atlanta, being in the Southerner. And people often ask me where I'm from, and I know exactly what kind of answer they're looking for. But, you know, this is the city I lived the longest. So I am, just as much as Korean, I'm also Southerner and Atlantan. So that peach is a symbol of that as well. So in Asian culture, peach is a symbol of longevity and then chase away the bad spirit. In Atlanta, peach is also the big symbol of South. But also people often look at it as a body part, which I don't mind. I actually find it really quite humorous and almost kind of do it slightly little more to catch that. So people think that it's a bosom or a baby butt and, you know, things like that. I really enjoy that.
Would you tell us a bit about your artistic training and how you developed your style?
Mm-hmm. I was trained as more likely realistic painter when I was in Korea. And in Korea, it's kind of funny. They have art painting department. It's two parts, one Western painting department. The other one is called Oriental painting department, which is Korean traditional art.
And they call it Oriental?
Yeah, I know it's a bad term right here, but that's what they call it there.
That's intriguing.
Yeah. So, but I was trained as an oil painter. So I graduated in Korea, both having BFA and MFA. My major was Western painting. So I've been painting oil on canvas for a long time. And then I came here, and then I went to school in University of Iowa, where I met my husband. After I have a luxurious time of having a large studio in grad school for 3 years, I realized how spoiled I was after I graduated, because the situation was different. I couldn't have a studio or anything. All I had was just one little table. So I had to switch medium. I couldn't make a large oil on canvas work. So that's the time that I look at traditional material again, and also paper as a serious material, because something dry quickly, but something you can always start fresh and new without having too much pressure, unlike white canvas. So it was eye-opening experience. And then, you know, ink and acrylic also. Acrylic is such a young medium. It's American invention, less than 100 years old, and it dries really fast. And it gives you a lot of opportunity to explore, making different surfaces and layerings. It requires different technique and time, which I really enjoyed. So it was just perfect.
It's interesting to hear you talk about how the circumstances, the physical circumstances of your studio space dictated the medium that you were working in. I don't think many people who aren't artists stop to consider that. The Hudgens Prize is the largest prize money for a single artist in the entire country. What would it help you accomplish, Jiha?
First of all, I think that if I never had to apply this type of competition, it would have been better, because I think that all artists deserve to have attention and get financially supported to do what they need to do. But if I had privilege to earn that money, I'll probably continue to explore and expand my practice. Also, I'm a mother and I have a family to support, and I want to contribute that this is also possible. Artist is a real job.
Yes, and one that can require hours, months, years of work. You mentioned your little boy. Does he paint with you?
Yes, he is always drawing and painting. But what we simply do is just giving the material, and we don't really try to teach him or anything. My husband is also an artist, and so he's surrounded by us, and then being in that environment is just really awesome. And he actually is kind of bossy, and he does not listen very well. So he also, that age, he acts like he knows everything. So it's very hard to instruct, but I think the best way is to provide what he wants to use, and that all we can do.
Does he give you comments about what he thinks you might add to?
About his work?
No, to
about
your
work. About my
work?
Yes, he's very funny.
He's a critic, too.
It's funny that he comes to my studio and he gives me always compliment how much he likes my work. I think it's because I'm his mom, but he is very sweet.
That is so sweet. Jiha Moon, I wish you good luck with the Hudgens competition and continued good fortune throughout your career.
Thank you so much.
Jiha Moon is one of the four finalists for the Hudgens Prize. They have a group exhibition that opens tomorrow evening at the Hudgens Center in Duluth. The opening reception is from 5 to 7 p.m., and the exhibition is up through October 21st. This is City Lights. Coming up next, Scott Adsit in the house.
Support for WABE comes from Moncrief Heating and Air Conditioning. Since 1898, offering HVAC services to home and businesses for over a century and available 365 days a year when you need us. MoncriefAir.com. And from the Mathnasium Learning Centers of Atlanta, committed to the idea that when kids understand math, they enjoy it and do more of it, leading to mastery. There are 26 Mathnasium centers around Atlanta. Mathnasium, we make math make sense.
This is City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes. So glad to be with you. And comedian, actor, improv artist, writer Scott Adsit. He played the producer Pete Hornberger on the NBC sitcom 30 Rock, among other accomplishments. And he's in town headlining a weekend of improv comedy at Dad's Garage. Scott Adsit, welcome to City Lights.
Hi, Lois. It's so nice to be here.
So good to have you here.
I love your voice. I feel like I'm sitting in a bathtub with you.
I won't go there.
Oh, I'm here already.
But thank you. Okay. Now, you're best known for your work as a scripted actor. I should say you're most widely known for your work as a scripted actor. Please tell us how you got into improv.
Well, I grew up in Chicago, or the suburbs of Chicago, and my parents would occasionally take me down to Second City and a bunch of other theater as well. But I really remember going to Second City like in junior high or thereabouts and seeing George Wendt and Tim Kazurinsky and Mary Gross and Danny Breen and all these really brilliant people doing something I'd never seen before. And so well and so funny. And it just seemed like a huge magic trick to me and something that was unobtainable. And then I ended up going to a high school that had an improv troupe. And the drama director there, Pat Murphy, was inspired by Second City and other things. And so he had this improv troupe, and they were kind of an elite members of the theater department. And they
this was at Glenbrook High School.
Glenbrook North, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they would do shows at assemblies and at special theater nights and stuff like that that actually did satire about the school we were going to and about the administration, about the rules, and about what was expected of students and the ironies of being in a school and being in that society. And we could actually make controversial statements. It was really eye-opening and really inspiring. So I ended up going to college to learn film, and I went to Columbia College in Chicago, and I kind of drifted back into acting because I'd done a lot of acting in high school. And I found that the teachers teaching me improv at Columbia also taught at Second City. And so they said, you ought to come to Second City. So I went and took classes there and eventually got hired. And then improv was like my life for a long time. And it still is a huge part of my life because I still improvise with the UCB in New York.
The Upright Citizens Brigade.
Yes, thank you. And then anywhere I can. You know, nobody gets paid for improv, but...
You mean that's not why you're here this weekend? Dad's Garage did not lure you here with a $1 million deal?
No, they put me up at a very nice hotel, though.
Good.
That's good enough.
I'm glad. Well, for anyone who might not be familiar with 30 Rock, we not only highly recommend that you download it, stream it, do whatever you can, because it is simply one of the most brilliant sitcoms ever written. And it also featured your character of Pete Hornberger. We're going to give listeners just a little taste of what Pete was like.
Oh, I can't remember any lines. I can't do any lines right now, Lois.
No, we have a clip.
Oh,
I didn't
God.
Want to impose
oh,
on you.
I just want to check everything out after your little gas scare.
Well, my pen light is working. That's good.
Now, can you say the alphabet for me?
Well, a very, very heavy, heavy debertation tonight. We had a very Darrison by... Let's go ahead, Terrestation. Let's go to the bit they haven't pit.
Excellent.
And that's your character after... Was there a gas leak?
There was a gas leak, yeah. And everyone was kind of affected by it. And that actually, what I said there is a quote from a woman who had some kind of a brain... event on air in a local newscast, and everyone was worried she had a stroke and everything. She turned out to be fine, but what I'm saying is an actual direct quote. I think you can go on YouTube and find a side-by-side of me and her saying it together.
That was not easy. I read that you spent days trying to memorize the nonsense.
Yeah, it was worse than trying to learn Shakespeare.
Which you did, and Oh my God! Did I read? You did something at Steppenwolf. Very heavy.
I did. Well, I did. At Steppenwolf, I did The Homecoming, which is a Harold Pinter play.
Yeah.
And I was. I think the current artistic director is Anna Shapiro, and she and I were at Columbia College together doing theater. And she had directed me in The Homecoming, and I was all of 21, 22, playing a 70-year-old, but it's college. And then they needed an understudy for Al Wilder, who was playing the role as a, I think, probably a 40-year-old, a 40-year-old man playing a 70-year-old. And Anna suggested me to be an understudy, so I went in and Jeff Perry auditioned me, and he took me on as a, whatever it was, 22, to play Max, who's 70, and then I think also understudied Sam as well, who's also up there.
Jeff Perry, who many viewers know from Scandal.
Oh, that's right. Work. Yeah, absolutely.
So you've done, you have some cred.
I do. I have some actual theater credibility.
And we're going to get to improv, the real purpose of this conversation, after a little bit more for people who just can't get enough of Pete. How did you land the role of Pete Hornberger on 30 Rock?
Well, I got a call around 2005, I guess. And it was Tina Fey, and we had worked together at Second City, and we did a lot of work together. We worked very closely, she and I. We had a lot of fun on stage, the two of us, in scenes where it was just kind of the two of us. And she called up and said, "Hey, I'm writing a sitcom pilot, and I have a role in mind for you. Would you be interested if that ever comes up in like a year?" And I said, "Yeah." So a year later, I get a call, and she says, "Okay, I have to audition you because the network doesn't trust me. And so I want you to come in, you know, do well. Don't screw this up." So I auditioned in LA, and then they took me to New York to do the final audition. And it was me and two other great actors who I adore. And I don't know if my audition was great or if Tina just wanted me in there, but something happened, and they said yes. So it was essentially that Tina wanted familiar faces around, I think, because she was a little nervous about leaving SNL and striking out on her own. She did very well, I think.
I would say so.
But the interesting thing, Lois, is that at the same time I was auditioning for a show called Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, which is...
Yes, Aaron Sorkin.
Right, on the same network, an hour-long version of 30 Rock that also played as a drama. It was backstage at SNL, and I was up for one of the leads in that, and I gotten to the point, in auditioning, you have to audition and then audition again, and then like a third audition, you have to sign a contract saying that if you get the role, you will be committed for like 6 years. And, you know, five guys sign that contract, and then they weed out. So I had to get to a point where I was signing to audition with Tina and also for Aaron Sorkin, and I was torn. You know, because Aaron Sorkin had just come off West Wing, and Tina was unproven and kind of like, you know, the woman that half the country didn't like on SNL on the Weekend Update. And so I made the choice to go with my friend because I wanted to support her. And I think I'd rather spend all day with her than Aaron Sorkin. He's probably a great guy. But at that point, I knew that I would rather spend a week making a pilot with Tina then 6 years with someone I didn't know.
See, friendship, that's a virtue.
It is, yeah.
You did something virtuous, and look what happened.
Yeah, and she was very kind to even think of me.
She's amazing.
Yeah.
So you were on 138 episodes of 30 Rock. Is there an episode or scene that you would call your favorite or most memorable for Pete?
For Pete? Oh. People ask me what my favorite episode is, I generally refer to episodes Pete wasn't in. I really like the one where Pete is trapped under the vending machine.
Oh, yes!
You remember that?
Yes!
Yeah, that was very Pete kind of thing. I also liked...
That was MILF Island?
Yes.
The Adventures on MILF Island?
That's right.
You guys pushed the limits there with the FCC, and I hope they are not... Okay. That was hilarious.
I wondered how you...
I hope that vending machine was very lightweight.
It was a fake vending machine when it was on top of me.
I'm heartened to know that. That was fabulous. You know, I'm thinking of some of the moments with the character of Pete that felt like your delivery of a line was so immediate. It felt unscripted. Like when Liz says, Tracy and Jen are acting like children, and you say, and like children, they can't be reasoned with. You just put a little whiskey in their juice bottle and wait for sleep to save you. Or, we Hornbergers are famous cowards. On D-Day, my grandfather wore a German uniform under his American one just in case. Were you improvising? Was there room for improv on 31?
Not really. We improvised at the ends of scenes and right at the beginnings of scenes generally because the scripts were so brilliant and written by people whose names have become famous in themselves since. And they really crafted beautiful, ornate little sculptures for us to perform. And to smash that with a better idea sounds ridiculous. So, no, we stuck to the scripts because they were so well crafted. And also, the writers would be on set. If things changed, the writers would be there to help us out. But Tina and I would add a line at the end of a scene or bring us into the scene with some kind of like weird something or other improv. But generally, I think everybody kind of respected the script and really felt lucky to have it. So we stuck to it. We were an ensemble with the writers.
Beautiful. If you've just tuned in, this is City Lights.
Oh, listen to that voice.
I'm Lois Wright.
Let me ask the producers if you could just add some like bath noises over this.
Bubbles?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just a little splish splash.
Our guest is comedian, actor, improv artist, and writer Scott Adsit. He's performing at Dad's Garage tonight and tomorrow night. We'll be back after a short break.
Pass the soap.
Support for WABE comes from WellStar Kennestone Hospital, which received Gold Seal Distinction for heart valve, coronary artery bypass surgery, and congestive heart failure. Kennestone is one of only two programs in the country to receive this distinction. WellStar.org.
And we're back with City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thanks for listening.
I am scrubbing Lois's back.
And it feels really good. Our guest is the comedian, actor, and writer Scott Adsit. Adsit, that was a spoonerism.
No.
No, that would have been Skit Adsit.
That's right.
Okay. Anyway, Scott's in town. He's performing at Dad's Garage Improv Theater tonight and tomorrow. Before we get into improv, I just want to ask you one more thing about your role on Veep.
Yes.
Which we also loved. You played a CNN news anchor.
Greg Horn.
How did you prepare for that? Did you talk with any CNN newscasters?
No, I just played an asshole. Can I say that?
You just did.
I got the role after I had auditioned for a different role, which I loved. And I got the role. And like the day before, they sent me a ticket to get on a train to go to Baltimore from New York. And they sent me the script, and I looked through the script, and my character wasn't in the script, and so I wrote to my manager, and apparently, they forgot that they had written the character out of the script, and the character then became someone they only talked about off camera. So I wasn't replaced; it was just the character was no longer on camera. So, and they, things move so fast and so they change so quickly with those writers that they just neglected to realize that Greg Horn was, or not Greg Horn, but whoever that guy was no longer in the show. So before that season was up, I was very disappointed. And before the season was up, they called again and said, hey, we got a role for you. It's just one episode and you'll enjoy it. And so I did like the election special. I hosted the election special as Greg. And then the next season, they kept bringing me back. So that was nice.
Yeah, and fun for viewers, too. I was wondering if it changed how you viewed the real election night last November, having played that fictional anchor role up for a presidential
election. I mean, everybody kind of agreed that reality has surpassed the surreality of the show, and it's the writers were having a hard time just writing something that seemed credible in a world where everything was incredible.
And yet they succeeded.
And yeah, by ignoring it. They did not write toward what was happening in the country, our great national tragedy.
And you got
the glorious leader.
And you got to work with another Second City alum, with Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Yes. Oh, boy, she's such a wonderful person. She's just the nicest. Doesn't have to be.
Okay, this leads into this whole ethics, the whatever, the universe of improv. Alan Alda was here in June promoting his recent book, and in it he explained why he thinks it's important for scientists and doctors to become more personal and more available to their audience, and he thinks that the way they can achieve that is by studying improv.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like improv is the new kale. I mean, it's, you know, it's the answer to happiness and a peaceful world.
It's a philosophy.
It really is. And where do you come in on that collaboration? What do you bring to the table, Scott?
Well, hopefully when I do a good show, it's because I'm making everyone else look good. That's the whole kind of tenet behind, say, any improv, is that your partners are more important than you, and you have to do whatever you can to give them a better show, to make them funnier, to make them more believable, and make everything they say much more important than anything you're going to say. And I think that's a good philosophy in life. It's not a black and white thing. It's not like I'm always inferior to you or lower status than you. It's not about that. It's just about serving what the other person needs in order to succeed, and listening and accepting everything as a good idea until it's not a good idea. And I think that applies to life. And a lot of improv philosophy really translates really well to your everyday life and how you can be happy yourself by serving others. Because you only look good when you are making other people look good. And also, it's just good to be interested. I said recently again one of the great lessons I learned in my classes was that you've got to be interested to be interesting on stage. And I think that applies to every day of your life as well. And little things like that really apply. And I think new students, kind of their eyes widen when they get it. And suddenly they're happier people. And they want to spread the word. You know?
It's a beautiful outlook on life. It's similar to what you've said, Alan Alda said, it's what democracy would be if we actually listened to each other.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
So we're seeing more actors in Hollywood, like yourself. I mean, you've been in films, and it seems that more and more improv actors are making it in other platforms as well, such as film. What do you think that means for the film industry?
It means they can get really sloppy because they'll rely too much on improv.
Ah.
I think there's a kind of a difference, I think, between improv and ad-libbing. And I think there's a lot of ad-libbing going on now in comedies especially. And you can always kind of tell when it's ad-libbed. And so I think there's got to be a bit of moderation and respect for the crafting of a script. 5 years ago, I would have said, you know, we should give them freedom. You know, if you've got the film, if it's all digital, if it doesn't take up too much time and money, then let them go. Let them improvise and find the great stuff. But in practice, I think it can kind of harm a good comedy.
Okay.
To tell you the truth, I don't know if that's blasphemous.
No, I think it's an important distinction because it seems effortless when you have a great improv artist. But when the curtain's pulled back, like with the ad-libbing and whatever nervous laughter, you know, comes along with it, that's not the same. Why are you doing these shows at Dad's Garage?
My sister lives in Atlanta, and they fly me in.
Oh.
No, that's not the only reason. But I've been with them several times. I came down first. They invited me, and I said, oh, I can visit my sister. And that worked out beautifully, but then I had a great time with everybody in the cast. So I just made sure to find room in my schedule every year to come back.
Well, we are so proud of what they do. And Pete Hornberger once said, the more people you add, the less effective it is. Like a neighborhood dad garage band. I came across that and I thought, well, adding you to Dad's Garage Improv Theater is very effective. Scott, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
And sharing your wonderful philosophy of improv thanks. And life.
Well, thank you for sharing your tub and your time.
It's been a very bubbling experience and very clean, too. Scott Adsit headlines 4 shows of improv comedy at Dad's Garage tonight and tomorrow night. We'll post this interview online later today at wabe.org/citylights. I hope we can have a Dewey's pizza together one day.
Oh, let's do that.
All right. In the tub.
And it won't be clean.
You've been listening to City Lights, a celebration of the arts and the ways in which we express ourselves creatively. You can catch an encore broadcast of our show tonight at 8. Tune in Sunday evening at 7. Emily Saliers of the Indigo Girls talks about Murmuration Nation, her first solo album, released 3 decades into her music career.
Support for WABE comes from Springer Mountain Farms' Southern Wing Showdown, produced by Taste of Atlanta, August 20th at the Foundry at Puritan Mill in Midtown. Wings from 25 Southern restaurants along with live music. Tickets at southernwingshowdown.com. And from Rosie's Roofing and Restoration, committed to keeping you cozy and dry regardless of the weather. Rosie's Roofing and Restoration, there when you need us, online at rosiesroofing.com.
Monday morning at 11 on City Lights, we have a galactically minded show for the Solar Eclipse Day. Contributor Scott Stewart helps us soundtrack the celestial events, and we'll talk to actor Sean Gunn about saving the universe in Guardians of the Galaxy 2. Our producers are Aaron Wright, Mike Johns, and Gabby Watts. WABE's MVP of radio is Christine Dempsey. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thanks so much for joining us for City Lights and for listening to member-supported 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.